Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Letter 37 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Sir Alexander Duff Gordon, Luxor, March 22, 1864. Dearest Alec, I am glad my letters amuse you. Sometimes I think they must breathe the unutterable dullness of Eastern life. Not that it is dull to me, a curious spectator, but how the men with nothing to do can endure it is a wonder. I went yesterday to call on a Turk at Karnak. He is a gentlemanly man, the son of a former mudder, who was murdered, I believe, for his cruelty and extortion. He has 1,000 feddans, acres or a little more, of land, and lives in a mud house, larger but no better than any fellow's, with two wives and the brother of one of them. He leaves the farm to his fellaheen altogether, I fancy. There was one book, a Turkish one. I could not read the title page, and he did not tell me what it was. In short, there was no means of killing time but the narghile. No horse, no gun, nothing, and yet they did not seem bored. The two women are always clamorous for my visits, and very noisy and schoolgirlish, but apparently excellent friends and very good-natured. The gentleman gave me a kufya, thick head kerchief for the sun, so I took the ladies a bit of silk I happened to have. You never heard anything like his raptures over Maurice's portrait. Mashallah, mashallah, wahali ze ilward. It is the will of God, and by God he is like a rose. But I can't cotton to the Turks. I always feel that they secretly dislike us European women, though they profess huge admiration and pay personal compliments, which an Arab very seldom attempts. I heard Salim Effendi and Omar discussing English ladies one day lately while I was inside the curtain with Salim's slave girl, and they did not know I heard them. Omar described Janet, and was of the opinion that a man who was married to her could want nothing more. By my soul, she rides like a Bedouin, she shoots with the gun and pistol, and rows the boat, she speaks many languages, works with the needle like an ifrit, and to see her hands run over the teeth of the music-box, keys of piano, amazes the mind, while her singing gladdens the soul. How, then, should her husband ever desire the coffee-shop? Wallahi, she can always amuse him at home. And as to my lady, the thing is not that she does not know. When I feel my stomach tightened, I go to the divan and say to her, "Do you want anything, a pipe or sherbet or so-and-so?" And I talk till she lays down her book and talks to me, and I question her and amuse my mind. And by God, if I were a rich man and could marry one English harem like that, I would stand before her and serve her like a memluk. You see, I am only this lady's servant, and I have not once sat in the coffee-shop because of the sweetness of her tongue. Is it not therefore true that the man who can marry such harem is rich more than with money? Salim seemed disposed to think a little more of looks, though he quite agreed with all Omar's enthusiasm, and asked if Janet were beautiful. Omar answered with decorous vagueness that she was a moon, but declined mentioning her hair, eyes, etc. It is a liberty to describe a woman minutely. I nearly laughed out at hearing Omar relate his maneuvers to make me amuse his mind. It seems I am in no danger of being discharged for being dull. The weather has set in so hot that I have shifted my quarters out of my fine room to the southwest, into one with only three sides, looking over a lovely green view to the northeast, with a huge sort of solid veranda, as large as the room itself, on the open side. Thus I live in the open air altogether. The bats and the swallows are quite sociable. I hope the serpents and scorpions will be more reserved. El Camasin, the 50, has begun, and the wind is enough to mix up heaven and earth, but it is not distressing like the Cape Southeaster, and, though hot, not choking like the Camasin in Cairo and Alexandria. Mohammed brought me a handful of the new wheat just now. Think of harvest in March and April. These winds are as good for the crops here as a nice steady rain is in England. It is not necessary to water so much when the wind blows strong. As I rode through the green fields along the dike, A little boy sang as he turned round on the musically creaking sakia, the water-wheel turned by an ox, the one eternal sakia tune. The words are ad libitum, and my little friend chanted, "Turn, O sakia, to the right and turn to the left. Who will take care of me if my father dies? Turn, O sakia," etc. "Pour water for the figs and the grass and for the watermelons. Turn, O sakia." Nothing is so pathetic as that sakia song. I passed the house of the Sheikh El Ababda, who called out to me to take coffee. The moon was splendid and the scene was lovely. The handsome black-brown sheikh in dark robes and white turban, Omar in a graceful white gown and red turban, and the wild Ababda, in all manner of dingy white rags, and with every kind of uncouth weapon, spears, matchlocks, etc., in every kind of wild and graceful attitude, with their long black ringlets and bare heads, a few little brown-black children, quite naked and shaped like cupids. And there we sat, and looked so romantic, and talked quite like ladies and gentlemen about the merits of Sakna and Almas, the two great rival women singers of Cairo. I think the sheikh wished to display his experiences of fashionable life. The Copts are now fasting and cross. They fast 55 days for Lent, no meat, fish, eggs, or milk, no exception for Sundays, no food till after 12 at noon, and no intercourse with the harem. The only comfort is lots of arak, and what a Copt can carry decently is an unknown quantity. One seldom sees them drunk, but they imbibe awful quantities. They offer me wine and arak always, and can't think why I don't drink it. I believe they suspect my Christianity in consequence of my preference for Nile water. As to that, though, they scorn all heretics, i.e. all Christians but themselves and the Abyssinians, more than they do the Muslims, and dislike them more. The procession of the Holy Ghost question divides us all with the gulf of Jehannam. The gardener of this house is a Copt, such a nice fellow, and he and Omar chafe one another about religion with the utmost good humor. Indeed, they are seldom touchy with the Muslims. There is a pretty little man called Mikael, a Copt, vakil to Monsieur Mounier. I wish I could draw him to show a perfect specimen of the ancient Egyptian race. His blood must be quite unmixed. He came here yesterday to speak to Ali Bey, the mudir of Kenna, who was visiting me. A splendid, handsome Turk he is, so little Mikael crept in to mention his business under my protection, and a few more followed, till Ali Bey got tired of holding a durbar in my divan and went away to his boat. You see, the people think the Karbash is not quite so handy with an English spectator. The other day Mustafa Aga got Ali Bey to do a little job for him, to let the people in Gezira, the island, which is Mustafa's property, work at a canal there instead of at the canal higher up for the Pasha. Very well, but down comes the Nazir, the Mudir's sub, and Korbash is the whole Gezira. Not Mustafa, of course, but the poor fellaheen who were doing his corvée instead of the Pasha's by the Mudir's order. I went to the Gezira and thought that Moses was at work again and had killed a firstborn in every house by the crying and wailing, when up came two fellows and showed me their bloody feet, which their wives were crying over like for a death. Shorgel el Miser, things of Egypt, like Cosas d'Espana. Last night I bored Sheikh Yusuf with Antara and Abu Zaid, maintaining the greater valour of Antara, who slew 10,000 for the love of Ibla. You know Antara. Yusuf looks down on such profanities and replied, "What are Antara and Abu Zaid compared to the combats of our Lord Moses with Og and other infidels of might? And what is the love of Antara for Ibla compared to that of our Lord Solomon for Balkis, Queen of Sheba, or their beauty and attractiveness to that of our Lord Joseph?" And then he relayed the combat of Sayyidina Musa with Og, and I thought, "Hear, O ye Puritans, and give ear, O ye Methodists, and learn how religion and romance are one to those whose manners and ideas are the manners and ideas of the Bible, and how Moses was not at all a crop-eared Puritan, but a gallant warrior." There is the Homeric element in the religion here. The prophet is a hero like Achilles, and like him directed by God, Allah instead of Athena. He fights, prays, teaches, makes love, and is truly a man, not an abstraction. And as to wonderful events, instead of telling one to gulp them down without looking, as children are told with a nasty dose, and as we are told about Genesis, etc., they believe them and delight in them, and tell them to amuse people. Such a piece of deep-disguised scepticism as Credo quia impossibile would find no favor here. What is impossible to God settles everything. In short, Muhammad has somehow left the stamp of romance on the religion, or else it is in the blood of people, though the Quran is prosy and commonsensical compared to the Old Testament. I used to think the Arabs intensely prosaic till I could understand a little of their language, but now I can trace the genealogy of Don Quixote straight up to some Sheikh el Arab. A fine, handsome woman with a lovely baby came to me the other day. I played with the baby and gave it a cotton handkerchief for its head. The woman came again yesterday to bring me a little milk and some salad as a present, and to tell my fortune with date stones. I laughed, and so she contented herself with telling Omar about his family, which he believed implicitly. She is a clever woman, evidently, and a great sibyl here. No doubt she has faith in her own predictions. She told Madame Meunier, who is a Levantine, that she would never have a child, and was forbidden the house accordingly, and the prophecy has come true. Superstition is wonderfully infectious here. The fact is that the Arabs are so intensely impressionable, and so cowardly about inspiring any ill will, that if a man looks askance at them, it is enough to make them ill, and as calamities are not infrequent, there is always some mishap ready to be laid to the charge of somebody's eye. Omar would fain have had me say nothing about the theft of my purse, for fear the Karnak people should hate me and give me the eye. A part of the boasting about property, etc., is politeness, so that one may not be supposed to be envious of one's neighbor's nice things. My Saka, water-carrier, admired my bracelet yesterday, as he was watering the veranda floor, and instantly told me of all the gold necklaces and earrings he had bought for his wife and daughters, that I might not be uneasy and fear his envious eye. He is such a good fellow. For 2 shillings a month he brings up 8 or 10 huge skins of water from the river a day, and never begs or complains, always merry and civil. I shall enlarge his backsheesh. There are a lot of camels who sleep in the yard under my veranda. They are pretty and smell nice, but they growl and swear at night abominably. I wish I could draw you an Egyptian farmyard, men, women, and cattle, but what no one can draw is the amber light, so brilliant and so soft, not like the Cape Diamond sunshine at all, but equally beautiful, hotter, and less dazzling. There is no glare in Egypt like the south of France, and, I suppose, in Italy. Thursday. I went yesterday afternoon to the island again to see the crops, and show Sally my friend farmer Omar's house and Mustafa's village. Of course we had to eat, and did not come home till the moon had long risen. Mustafa's brother, Abdulrahman, walked about with us, such a noble-looking man, tall, spare, dignified and active, gray-bearded and hard-featured, but as lithe and bright-eyed as a boy, scorning any conveyance but his own feet, and quite dry while we ran down. He was like Boaz, the wealthy gentleman peasant. Nothing except the biblical characters give any idea of the rich fella. We sat and drank new milk in a lodge in a garden of cucumbers. The lodge is a neat hut of palm branches, and saw the moon rise over the mountains and light up everything like a softer sun. Here you see all colors as well by moonlight as by day, hence it does not look as brilliant as the Cape moon, or even as I have seen in Paris, where it throws sharp black shadows and white light. The night here is a tender, subdued, dreamy sort of enchanted-looking day. My Turkish acquaintance from Karnak has just been here. He boasted of his house in Damascus, and invited me to go with him after the harvest here, also of his beautiful wife in Syria, and then begged me not to mention her to his wives here. It is very hot now. What will it be in June? It is now 86 degrees in my shady room at noon. It will be hotter at 2 or 3. But the mornings and evenings are delicious. I am shedding my clothes by degrees. Stockings are unbearable. Meanwhile my cough is almost gone, and the pain is quite gone. I feel much stronger, too. The horrible feeling of exhaustion has left me. I suppose I must have salamander blood in my body to be made lively by such heat. Sally is quite well. She does not seem at all the worse at present. Saturday. This will go tomorrow by some travellers, the last winter swallows. We went together yesterday to the tombs of the kings on the opposite bank. The mountains were red-hot, and the sun went down into Amenti, all on fire. We met Mr. Dumichin, the German, who was living in the temple of Deir el-Bari, translating inscriptions, and went down Belzoni's tomb. Mr. Dumichin translated a great many things for us which were very curious, and I think I was more struck with the beauty of the drawing of the figures than last year. The face of the goddess of the western shore, Amenti, Athor, or Hecate, is ravishing as she welcomes the king to her regions. Death was never painted so lovely. The road is a long and most wild one, truly through the valley of the shadow of death, not an insect nor a bird. Our moonlight ride home was beyond belief beautiful. The Arabs who followed us were immensely amused at hearing me interpret between German and English, and at my speaking Arabic. They asked if I was dragoman of all the languages in the world. One of them had droll theories about Amalika, America, as they pronounce it always. Was the king very powerful that the country was called Al-Malika, the king's? I said, no, all are kings there. You would be a king like the rest. My friend disapproved utterly. If all are kings, then must be taking away every man the other's money. A delightful idea of the kingly vocation. When we landed on the opposite shore, I told little Achmet to go back in the ferry-boat, in which he had brought me over my donkey. A quarter of an hour after, I saw him by my side. The guide asked why he had not gone as I told him. Who would take care of the lady? The monkey is Rainy's size. Of course he got tired, and on the way home I told him to jump up behind me and crouper after the fellah fashion. I thought the Arabs would never have done laughing and saying voila and mashallah. Sheikh Yusuf talked about the excavations, and is shocked at the way the mummies are kicked about. One boy told him they were not Muslims as an excuse, and he rebuked him severely and told him it was haram, accursed, to do so to the children of Adam. He says they have learned it very much of Mariette Bey, but I suspect it was always so with the fellaheen. Today a tremendous wind is blowing, excellent for the corn. At Mustafa's farm they are preparing for the harvest, baking bread and selecting a young bull to be killed for the reapers. It is not hot today, only 84 degrees in a cool room. The dust is horrid with this high wind. Everything is gritty, and it obscures the sun. I am desired to eat a raw onion every day during the Khamsin for health and prosperity. This, too, must be a remnant of ancient Egypt. How I do long to see you and the children. Sometimes I feel rather downhearted, but it is no good to say all that, and I am much better and stronger. I stood a long ride and some scrambling quite well last evening. End of letter 37. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 38 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Sir Alexander Duff Gordon, Luxor, April 6, 1864. Dearest Alec, I received yours of March 10th 2 days ago, one also from Hekekian Bay, much advising me to stay here the summer and get my disease evaporated. Since I last wrote, the great heat abated, and now we have 76 to 80 degrees, with strong north breezes up the river. Glorious weather, neither too hot nor chilly at any time. Last evening I went out to the threshing floor to see the stately oxen treading out the corn, and supped there with Abdurrahman on roasted corn, sour cream, and eggs, and saw the reapers take their wages, each a bundle of wheat according to the work he had done, the most lovely sight. The graceful, half-naked, brown figures loaded with sheaves, some had earned so much that their mothers or wives had to help carry it, and little fawn-like, stark-naked boys trudged off, so proud of their little bundles of wheat, or of hamuz, sort of vetch, much eaten, both green and roasted. The Saka, water-carrier, who has brought water for the men, gets a handful from each, and drives home his donkey with empty water-skins and a heavy load of wheat, and the barber who has shaved all these brown heads on credit this year gets his past pay, and every one is cheerful and happy in their gentle, quiet way. Here is no beer to make men sweaty and noisy and vulgar. The harvest is the most exquisite pastoral you can conceive. The men work 7 hours in the day, i.e. 8, with half-hours to rest and eat, and 7 more during the night. They go home at sunset to dinner, and sleep a bit, and then to work again, these lazy Arabs. The man who drives the oxen on the threshing floor gets a measure and a half for his day and night's work, of thresh corn, I mean. As soon as the wheat, barley, adas, lentils, and hamuz are cut, we shall sow dura of 2 kinds, common maize and Egyptian, and plant sugar cane and later cotton. The people work very hard, but here they eat well, and being paid in corn, they get the advantage of the high price of corn this year. I told you how my purse had been stolen, and the proceedings thereanent. Well, Mustafa asked me several times what I wished to be done with the thief, who spent 21 days here in irons. With my absurd English ideas of justice, I refused to interfere at all, and Omar and I had quite a tiff because he wished me to say, "Oh, poor man, let him go. I leave the affair to God." I thought Omar absurd, but it was I who was wrong. The authorities concluded that it would oblige me very much if the poor devil were punished with a rigor beyond the law, and had not Sheikh Yusuf come and explained the nature of the proceedings, the man would have been sent up to the mines in Fazaglo for life, out of civility to me, by the Mudir of Kenna, Ali Bey. There was no alternative between my forgiving him for the love of God, or sending him to a certain death by a climate insupportable to these people. Mustafa and company tried hard to prevent Sheikh Yusuf from speaking to me, for fear I should be angry and complain at Cairo, if my vengeance were not wreaked on the thief. But he said he knew me better, and brought the process verbal to show me. Fancy my dismay! I went to Salim Effendi and to the Qadi with Sheikh Yusuf, and begged the man might be let go, and not sent to Kenna at all. Having settled this, I said that I had thought it right that the people of Karnak should pay the money I had lost, as a fine for their bad conduct to strangers, but that I did not require it for the sake of the money, which I would accordingly give to the poor of Luxor in the mosque and in the church. Great applause from the crowd. I asked how many were Muslimin and how many Nazrini, in order to divide the 3 napoleons and a half, according to the numbers. Sheikh Yusuf awarded 1 napoleon to the church, 2 to the mosque, and the half to the water-drinking place, the Sabil, which was also applauded. I then said, "Shall we send the money to the bishop?" But a respectable elderly Copt said, "Malkish, never mind, better give it all to Sheikh Yusuf. He will send the bread to the church." Then the Qadi made me a fine speech, and said I had behaved like a great emira, and one that feared God, and Sheikh Yusuf said that he knew the English had mercy in their stomachs, and that I especially had Mussulman feeling, as we say Christian charity. Did you ever hear of such a state of administration of justice? Of course, sympathy here, as in Ireland, is mostly with the poor man in prison, in trouble, as we say. I find that accordingly a vast number of disputes are settled by private arbitration, and Yusuf is constantly sent for to decide between contending parties, who abide by his decision rather than go to law, or else 5 or 6 respectable men are called upon to form a sort of amateur jury, and to settle the matter. In a criminal case, if the prosecutor is powerful, he has it all his own way. If the prisoner can bribe high, he is apt to get off. All the appealing to my compassion was quite en regale, another trait of Egypt. The other day we found all our water jars empty and our house unsprinkled. On inquiry it turned out that the Sakas had all run away, carrying with them their families and goods, and were gone no one knew whither, in consequence of some persons having authority, one, a Turkish Kawas, policeman, having forced them to fetch water for building purposes at so low a price that they could not bear it. My poor Saka is gone without a whole month's pay, 2 shillings, the highest pay by far given in Luxor. I am interested in another story. I hear that a plucky woman here has been to Kenna and threatened the Mudir that she will go to Cairo and complain to Effendina himself of the unfair drafting for soldiers, her only son taken while others have bribed off. She'll walk in this heat all the way unless she succeeds in frightening the Mudir, which, as she is of the more spirited sex in this country, she may possibly do. You see, these Saides are a bit less patient than lower Egyptians. The Sakas can strike, and a woman can face a Mudir. You would be amused at the bazaar here. There is a barber, and on Tuesdays some beads, calico and tobacco are sold. The only artisan is a jeweler. We spin and weave our own brown woolen garments, and have no other wants, but gold necklaces and nose and earrings are indispensable. It is the safest way of hoarding, and happily combines saving with ostentation. Can you imagine a house without beds, chairs, tables, cups, glasses, knives, in short, with nothing but an oven, a few pipkins and water jars, and a couple of wooden spoons, and some mats to sleep on? And yet people are happy and quite civilized who live so. An Arab cook, with his fingers and 1 cooking pot, will serve you an excellent dinner quite miraculously. The simplification of life possible in such a climate is not conceivable unless one has seen it. The Turkish ladies whom I visit at Karnak have very little more. They are very fond of me, and always want me to stay and sleep. But how could I sleep in my clothes on a mat divan, poor spoiled European that I am? But they pity and wonder far more at the absence of my master. I made a bad slip of the tongue and said my husband before Abul Rafia, the master of the house. The ladies laughed and blushed tremendously, and I felt very awkward, but they turned the tables on me in a few minutes by some questions they had asked quite coolly. I hardly know what I shall have to do. If the heat does not turn overpowering, I shall stay here. If I cannot bear it, I must go down the river. I asked Omar if he could bear a summer here, so dull for such a young man, fond of a little coffee-shop and gossip, for that, if he could not, he might go down for a time and join me again, as I could manage with some man here. He absolutely cried, kissed my hands, and declared he was never so happy as with me, and he could not rest if he thought I had not all I wanted. I am your memlook, not your servant, your memlook. I really believe that these people sometimes love their English masters better than their own people. Omar certainly has shown the greatest fondness for me on all occasions. End of letter 38. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 39 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Mrs. Ross, Luxor, April 7, 1864. Dearest Janet, I have continued very fairly well. We had great heat 10 days ago. Now it is quite cool. Harvesting is going on, and I never did see in any dream so lovely a sight as the whole process. An acquaintance of mine, one Abdul Rahman, is Boaz, and as I sat with him on the threshing floor and ate roasted corn, I felt quite puzzled as to whether I were really alive or only existing in an imagination in the Book of Ruth. It is such a kief that one enjoys under the palm trees, with such a scene. The harvest is magnificent here. I never saw such crops. There is no cattle disease, but a good deal of sickness among the people. I have to practice very extensively, and often feel very anxious, as I cannot refuse to go to the poor souls and give them medicine, with sore misgivings all the while. Fancy that Hekekian Bey can't get me an Arabic dictionary in Cairo. I must send to London, I suppose, which seems hardly worth while. I wish you could see my teacher, Sheikh Yusuf. I never before saw a pious person amiable and good like him. He is intensely devout and not at all bigoted, a difficult combination, and moreover he is lovely to behold and has the prettiest and merriest laugh possible. It is quite curious to see the mixture of a sort of learning with utter ignorance and great superstition, and such perfect high breeding and beauty of character. It is exactly like associating with St. John. I want dreadfully to be able to draw or to photograph. The group at the Sheikh al-Ababda's last night was ravishing, all but my ugly hat and self. The black ringlets and dirty white drapery and obsolete weapons, the graceful, splendid Sheikh, black but beautiful like the Shalumite, I thought of Antar and Abu Zaid. Give my salam to Madame Tastu, and ask her whether I may stay on here, or if I go downstream during the heat, whether I may return next winter, in which case I might leave some of my goods. Hekekian strongly advises me to remain here, and thinks the heat will be good. I will try. 88 degrees seem to agree with me wonderfully. My cough is better. End of letter 39. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 40 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Sir Alexander Duff Gordon, Luxor, April 14, 1864. Dearest Alec, I have but this moment received your letter of the 18th March, which went after Janet, who was hunting at Tel el-Kebir. We have had a tremendous Khamseen wind, and now a strong north wind, quite fresh and cool. The thermometer was 92 degrees during the Khamseen, but it did me no harm. Luckily I am very well, for I am worked hard, as a strange epidemic has broken out, and I am the Hakima, doctoress, of Luxor. The Hakim Pasha from Cairo came up and frightened the people, telling them it was catching, and Yusuf forgot his religion so far as to beg me not to be all day in the people's huts. But Omar and I despised the danger, I feeling sure it was not infectious, and Omar saying, Min Allah. The people get stoppage of the bowels and die in 8 days unless they are physicked. All who have sent for me in time have recovered. Alhamdulillah, that I can help the poor souls. It is harvest, and the hard work, and the spell of intense heat, and the green corn, beans, etc., which they eat, brings on the sickness. Then the Copts are fasting from all animal food, and full of green beans and salad, and green corn. Mustafa tried to persuade me not to give physic, for fear those who died should pass for being poisoned, but Omar and I are sure it is only to excuse his own selfishness. Omar is an excellent assistant. The bishop tried to make money by hinting that if I forbade my patients to fast, I might pay for their indulgence. One poor, peevish little man refused the chicken broth, and told me that we Europeans had our heaven in this world. Omar let out kelb, dog, but I stopped him and said, "Oh, my brother, God has made the Christians of England unlike those of Egypt, and surely will condemn neither of us on that account. Mayest thou find a better heaven hereafter than I now enjoy here." Omar threw his arms round me and said, "Oh, thou good one, surely our Lord will reward thee for acting thus with the meekness of a Muslimah and kissing the hand of him who strikes thy face. See how each religion claims humility." Suleiman was not pleased at his fellow Christians' display of charity. It does seem strange that the Copts of the lower class will not give us the blessing or thank God for our health like the Muslimin. Most of my patients are Christians, and some are very nice people indeed. The people here have named me Siti, Lady, Nur ala Nur. A poor woman whose only child, a young man, I was happy enough to cure when dreadfully ill, kissed my feet and asked by what name to pray for me. I told her my name meant Nur, light lux, but as that was one of the names of God, I could not use it. "Thy name is Nur ala Nur," said a man who was in the room. "That means something like, God is upon thy mind, or light from the light, and Nur ala Nur it remains. A combination of one of the names of God is quite proper, like Abdallah, Abdurrahman, etc." I begged some medicines from a Countess Braniski, who went down the other day. When all is gone, I don't know what I shall do. I am going to try to make castor oil. I don't know how, but I shall try, and Omar fancies he can manage it. The cattle disease has also broken out desperately up in Esna, and we see the dead beasts float down all day. Of course, we shall soon have it here. Sunday, April 17th. The epidemic seems to be over, but there is still a great deal of gastric fever, etc., about. The Hakim from Kenna has just been here, such a pleasing, clever young man, speaking Italian perfectly, and French extremely well. He is the son of some fella of Lower Egypt, sent to study at Pisa, and has not lost the Arab gentility and elegance by a Frenghi education. We fraternized greatly, and the young Hakim was delighted at my love for his people and my high opinion of their intelligence. He has gone now to inspect the sick, and is to see me again and give me directions. He was very unhappy that he could not supply me with medicines. None are to be bought above Cairo, except from the hospital doctors, who sell the medicines of the government, as the Italian at Siout did. But Ali Effendi is too honest for that. The old bishop paid me a visit of 3.5 hours yesterday, and pour me tirer une carotte he sent me a loaf of sugar, so I must send a present for the church to be consumed in Raki. The old party was not very sober, and asked for wine. I coolly told him it was haram, forbidden to us to drink during the day, only with our dinner. I will never give the Christians drink here, and now they have left off pressing me to drink spirits at their houses. The bishop offered to alter the hour of prayer for me, and to let me into the Hekhil, where women must not go, on Good Friday, which will be 18 days hence. All of which I refused, and said I would go on the roof of the church and look down through the windows with the other Harimat. Omar kissed the bishop's hand, and I said, "What, do you kiss his hand like a Copt?" "Oh yes, he is an old man, and a servant of my God, but dreadful a dirty," added Omar, and it was too true. His presence diffused a fearful monastic odor of sanctity. A bishop must be a monk, as priests are married. Monday. Today Ali Effendi el-Hakim came to tell me how he had been to try to see my patients and failed. All the families declared they were all well and would not let him in. Such is the deep distrust of everything to do with the government. They all waited till he was gone away, and then came again to see me with their ailments. I scolded, and they all said, "Voila, ya sit, ya emira, that is the Hakim Pasha, and he would send us off to hospital at Kenna, and then they would poison us. By thy eyes, do not be angry with us, or leave off from having compassion on us on this account." I said, "Ali Effendi is an Arab and a Muslim and an emir, gentleman, and he gave me good advice and would have given more, etc. No use at all. He is the government doctor, and they had rather die, and will swallow anything from El Siti nor Alanor. Here is a pretty state of things." I gave Sheikh Yusuf £4 for 3 months' daily lessons last night, and had quite a contest to force it upon him. "It is not for money, old lady," and he colored crimson. He had been about with Ali Effendi, but could not get the people to see him. The Copts, I find, have a religious prejudice against him, and indeed against all heretics. They consider themselves and the Abyssinians as the only true believers. If they acknowledge us as brethren, it is for money. I speak only of the low class and of the priests. Of course the educated merchants are very different. I had a priest and two deacons, and the mother of one, here today for physic for the woman. She was very pretty and pleasing, miserably reduced and weak from the long fast. I told her she must eat meat and drink a little wine and take cold baths, and gave her quinine. She will take the wine and the quinine, but neither eat nor wash. The bishop tells them they will die if they break the fast, and half the Christians are ill from it. One of the priests spoke a little English. He fabricates false antiques very cleverly, and is tolerably sharp. But, oh, mon Dieu, it is enough to make one turn Muslim to compare these greasy rogues with such high-minded, charitable Sharifa, noblemen, as Abd al-Waris and Sheikh Yusuf. A sweet little Copt boy who is very ill will be killed by the stupid bigotry about the fast. My friend Suleiman is much put out, and backs my exhortations to the sick to break it. He is a capital fellow and very intelligent, and he and Omar are like brothers. It is the priests who do all they can to keep alive religious prejudice. Alhamdulillah, they are only partially successful. Mohammed has just heard that 75 head of cattle are dead at El Montana. Here only a few have died as yet, and Ali Effendi thinks the disease less virulent than in Lower Egypt. I hope he is right, but dead beasts float down the river all day long. To turn to something more amusing, but please don't tell it, such a joke against my gray hairs. I have had a proposal, or at least an attempt at one. A very handsome Sheikh el-Arab, Bedawi, was here for a bit, and asked Omar whether I were a widow or divorced, as in either case he would send a Delela, marriage brokeress, to me. Omar told him that I would never do. I had a husband in England. Besides, I was not young, had a married daughter, my hair was gray, etc. The Sheikh swore he didn't care, I could dye my hair and get a divorce, that I was not like stupid modern women, but an ancient Arab emira, and worthy of Antar, or Abu Zaid, a woman for whom men killed each other or themselves, and he would pay all he could afford as my dowry. Omar came in fits of laughter at the idea, and the difficulty he had in stopping the Delela's visit. He told the Sheikh I should certainly beat her, I should be so offended. The disregard of differences of age here on marriage is very strange. My adorer was not more than 30, I am sure. Don't tell people, my dear Alec, it is so very absurd. I should be ashamed before the people. Saturday, April 23rd. Alhamdulillah, the sickness is going off. I have just heard Suleiman's report as follows. Hassan Abu Ahmed kisses the Emir's feet, and the bullets have cleaned his stomach 6 times, and he has said the Fatah for the lady. The 2 little girls who had diarrhea are well. The Christian dyer has vomited his powder and wants another. The mother of the Christian cook who married the priest's sister has got dysentery. The harem of Mustafa Abu Abayed has 2 children with bad eyes. The bishop had a quarrel, and scolded and fell down, and cannot speak or move. I must go to him. The young deacon's jaundice is better. The slave girl of Kershid Aga is sick, and Kershid is sitting at her head in tears, The women say I must go to her, too. Khurshid is a fine young Turk, and very good to his harimat. That is all. Suleiman has got nothing on earth to do, and brings me a daily report. He likes the gossip and the importance. The Rais of a cargo boat brought me up your La Fontaine, and some papers and books from Hekekian Bay. Sheikh Yusuf is going down to Cairo, to try to get back some of the lands which Muhammad Ali took away from the mosques and the ulema without compensation. He asked me whether Ross would speak for him to Effendina. What are the Muslimin coming to? As soon as I can read enough, he offers to read in the Qur'an with me. A most unusual proceeding, as the noble Qur'an is not generally put into the hands of heretics. But my charity to the people in sickness is looked upon by Abd el-Waris, the Imam, and by Yusuf, as a proof that I have received direction, and I am one of those Christians of whom Sayyidina Muhammad, upon whose name be peace, has said that they have no pride, that they rival each other in good works, and that God will increase their reward. There is no arrière-pensée of conversation that they think hopeless, but charity covers all sins with Musulman. Next Friday is the Jima el-Kebr, Good Friday, with the Copts, and the prayers are in the daytime, so I shall go to the church. Next moon is the great Biram, el-Eid el-Kebr, the great festival, with the Musulman, the commemoration of the sacrifice of Isaac or Ishmael, commentators are uncertain which, and Omar will kill a sheep for the poor for the benefit of his baby, according to custom. I have at length compassed the destruction of mine enemy, though he has not written a book. A fanatical Christian dog, quadruped, belonging to the Coptic family who live on the opposite side of the yard, hated me with such virulent intensity that, not content with barking at me all day, he howled at me all night, even after I had put out the lantern and he could not see me in bed. Sentence of death has been recorded against him, as he could not be beaten into toleration. Mikhail, his master's son, has come down from El Montana, where he is vakil to Monsieur Mounier. He gives a fearful account of the sickness there among men and cattle, 8 and 10 deaths a day. Here we have had only 4 a day, at the worst, in a population of, I guess, some 2,000. The Mouniers have put themselves in quarantine, and allow no one to approach their house, as Mustafa wanted me to do. 150 head of cattle have died at El Montana. Here only a few calves are dead, but as yet no full-grown beasts, and the people are healthy again. I really think I did some service by not showing any fear, and Omar behaved manfully. By the by, will you find out whether a passaporto, as they call it, a paper granting British protection, can be granted in England? It is the object of Omar's highest ambition to belong as much as possible to the English, and feel safe from being forced to serve a Turk. If it can be done by any coaxing and jobbling, pray do it, for Omar deserves any service I can render him in return for all his devotion and fidelity. Someone tried to put it into his head that it was haram to be too fond of us heretics and be faithful, but he consulted Sheikh Yusuf, who promised him a reward hereafter for good conduct to me, and who told me of it as a good joke, adding that he was Raghil Amin, the highest praise for fidelity, the sobriquet of the Prophet. Do not be surprised at my lack of conscience in desiring to benefit my own follower in calconque modo. Justice is not of Eastern growth, and Europeo is your only wear, and here it is only base not to stick by one's friends. Omar kisses the hands of the Sidi el-Kebr, the great master, and desires his best salam to the little master and the little lady, whose servant he is. He asks if I, too, do not kiss Iskender Bey's hand in my letter, as I ought to do as his harem, or whether I make myself big before my master, like some French ladies he has seen. I tell him I will do so if Iskender Bey will get him his warak, paper, whereupon he picks up the hem of my gown and kisses that, and I civilly expostulate on such condescension to a woman. Yusuf is quite puzzled about European women, and a little shocked at the want of respect to their husbands they display. I told him that the outward respect shown to us by our men was our veil, and explained how superficial the difference was. He fancied that the law gave us the upper hand. Omar reports yesterday's sermon on toleration, it appears. Yusuf took the text of Thou shalt love thy brother as thyself, and never act towards him but as thou wouldst, he would act towards thee. I forget chapter and verse, but it seems he took the bull by the horns and declared all men to be brothers, not Muslimin only, and desired his congregation to look at the good deeds of others and not at their erroneous faith, for God is all-knowing, i.e. he only knows the heart, and if they saw aught amiss to remember that the best man needs say Astaghfir Allah, I beg pardon of God, 7 times a day. I wish the English could know how unpleasant and mischievous their manner of talking to their servants about religion is. Omar confided to me how bad it felt to be questioned, and then to see the Englishman laugh or put up his lip and say nothing. I don't want to talk about his religion at all, but if he talks about mine he ought to speak of his own too. You, my lady, say, when I tell you things, that is the same with us, or that is different, or good, or not good in your mind, and that is the proper way, not to look like thinking all nonsense. Esna, Saturday, April 30th. On Thursday evening, as I was dreamily sitting on my divan, who should walk in but Arthur Taylor, on his way, all alone in a big dahabiyah, to Edfu. So I offered to go too, whereupon he said he would go to Aswan and see Philae, as he had company, and we went off to Mustapha to make a bargain with his Rais for it. Thus, then, here we are at Esna. I embarked on Wednesday evening, and we have been 2 days en route. Yesterday we had the thermometer at 110. I was the only person awake all day in the boat. Omar, after cooking, lay panting at my feet on the deck. Omar went fairly to bed in the cabin, ditto Sally. All the crew slept on the deck. Omar cooked amphibiously, bathing between every meal. The silence of noon, with the white heat glowing on the river, which flowed like liquid tin, and the silent Nubian rough boats floating down without a ripple, was magnificent and really awful. Not a breath of wind as we lay under the lofty bank. The Nile is not quite so low, and I see a very different scene from last year. People think us crazy to go up to Aswan in May. But I do enjoy it, and I really wanted to forget all the sickness and sorrow in which I have taken part. When I went to Mustafa's, he said Sheikh Yusuf was ill, and I said, then I won't go. But Yusuf came in with a sick headache only. Mustapha repeated my words to him, and I never did see such a lovely expression in a human face as that with which Yusuf said, Aya, sit. Mustapha laughed and told him to thank me, and Yusuf turned to me and said in a low voice, my sister does not need thanks, save from God. Fancy a sharif, one of the ulema, calling a frangaya sister. His pretty little girl came in and played with me, and he offered her to me for Maurice. I cured Kershid's Abyssinian slave girl. You would have laughed to see him obeying my directions and wiping his eyes on his gold-embroidered sleeve. And then the Coptic priest came to me for his wife, who was ill. He was in a great quandary, because if she died, he, as a priest, could never marry again, as he loudly lamented before her, but he was truly grieved, and I was very happy to leave her convalescent. Verily, we are sorely visited. The dead cattle float down by thousands. Monsieur Meunier buried 1,000 at El Montana alone, and lost 40 men. I would not have left Luxor, but there were no new cases for 4 days before, and the worst had been over for full 10 days. 2 or 3 poor people brought me new bread and vegetables to the boat when they saw me going, and Yusuf came down and sat with us all evening, and looked quite sad. Omar asked him why, and he said it made him think how it would seem when Inshallah should be well, and should leave my place empty at Luxor, and go back with the blessing of God to my own place and to my own people. Whereupon Omar grew quite sentimental too, and nearly cried. I don't know how Arthur would have managed without us, for he had come with 2 Frenchmen who had proper servants and who left the boat at Girga, and he has a wretched, little, dirty, idiotic Coptic tailor as a servant, who can't even sew on a button. It is becoming quite a calamity about servants here. Arthur tells me that men not fit to light Omar's pipe asked him £10 a month in Cairo and would not take less, and he gives his Copt £4. I really feel as if I were cheating Omar to let him stay on for £3, but if I say anything he kisses my hand and tells me not to be cross. I have letters from Yusuf to people at Aswan. If I want anything I am to call on the Qadi. We have a very excellent boat and a good crew, and are very comfortable. When the Luxor folk heard the son of my uncle was come, they thought it must be my husband. I was diverted at Omar's propriety. He pointed out to Mustapha and Yusuf how he was to sleep in the cabin between Arthur's and mine, which was considered quite satisfactorily, apparently, and was looked upon as very proper of Omar to have arranged it so, as he had been sent to put the boat in order. Arthur has been all along the Suez Canal, and seen a great many curious things. The Delta must be very unlike Upper Egypt, from all he tells me. The little troop of pilgrims for Mecca left Luxor about 10 days ago. It was a pretty and touching sight. 3 camels, 5 donkeys, and about 30 men and women, several with babies on their shoulders, all uttering the Zaghareet cry of joy. They were to walk to Khozer, 8 days' journey with good camels, babies and all. It is the happiest day of their lives, they say, when they have scraped together money enough to make the Hajj. This minute a poor man is weeping beside our boat over a pretty heifer decked with many hagubs, amulets, which have not availed her against the sickness. It is heart-rending to see the poor beasts and their unfortunate owners. Some dancing girls came to the boat just now for cigars, which Arthur had promised them, and to ask after their friend El Maghribia, the good dancer at Luxor, whom they said was very ill. Omar did not know at all about her, and the girls seemed very much distressed. They were both very pretty, one an Abyssinian. I must leave off to send this to the post. It will cost a fortune, but you won't grudge it. End of letter 40. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 41 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Sir Alexander Duff Gordon, Luxor, May 15, 1864, day before Eid el-Kebir, Bahram. Dearest Alec, we returned to Luxor the evening before last, just after dark. The salute which Omar fired with your old horse pistols brought down a lot of people, and there was a chorus of Alhamdulillah Salama Yasit, and such a kissing of hands, and welcome home to your place, and we have tasted your absence and found it bitter, etc., etc. Mustafa came with letters for me, and Yusuf beaming with smiles, and Mohammed with new bread made of new wheat, and Suleiman with flowers, and little Ahmet rushing in wildly to kiss hands. When the welcome had subsided, Yusuf, who stayed to tea, told me all the cattle were dead. Mustafa lost 34, and has 3 left, and poor farmer Omar lost all, 40 head. The distress in Upper Egypt will now be fearful. Within 6 weeks all our cattle are dead. They are threshing the corn with donkeys, and men are turning the sakiyas, water wheels, and drawing the ploughs, and dying by scores of overwork and want of food in many places. The whole agriculture depended on the oxen, and they are all dead. At El Montana and 9 villages around Halim Pasha's estate, 24,000 head have died. 4 beasts were left when we were there 3 days ago. We spent 2 nights and days at Philae and Wahali. It was hot. The basalt rocks which enclosed the river all around the island were burning. Sally and I slept in the Osiris chamber, on the roof of the temple, on our airbeds. Omar lay across the doorway to guard us, and Arthur and his Copt, with the well-bred sailor Ramadan, were sent to bivouac on the pylon. Ramadan took the harem under his special and most respectful charge, and waited on us devotedly, but never raised his eyes to our faces, or spoke till spoken to. Philae is 6 or 7 miles from Aswan, and we went on donkeys through the beautiful Shalalia, the village of the cataract, and the noble place of tombs of Aswan. Great was the amazement of every one at seeing Europeans so out of season. We were like swallows in January to them. I could not sleep for the heat in the room, and threw on an abaya, cloak, and went and lay on the parapet of the temple. What a night! What a lovely view! The stars gave as much light as the moon in Europe, and all but the cataract was still as death and glowing hot, and the palm trees were more graceful and dreamy than ever. Then Omar woke, and came and sat at my feet, and rubbed them, and sang a song of a Turkish slave. I said, "Do not rub my feet, O brother, that is not fit for thee, because it is below the dignity of a free Muslim altogether to touch shoes or feet." But he sang in his song, "The slave of the Turk may be set free by money, but how shall one be ransomed who has been paid for by kind actions and sweet words?" Then the day broke deep crimson, and I went down and bathed in the Nile, and saw the girls on the island opposite in their summer fashions, consisting of a leathern fringe round their slender hips, divinely graceful, bearing huge saucer-shaped baskets of corn on their stately young heads, and I went up and sat at the end of the colonnade looking up into Ethiopia, and dreamed dreams of him who sleeps in Philae, until the great Amun-Ra kissed my northern face too hotly, and drove me into the temple to breakfast, and coffee, and pipes, and kief. And in the evening three little naked Nubians rowed us about for 2 or 3 hours on the glorious river in a boat made of thousands of bits of wood, each a foot long, and between whiles they jumped overboard and disappeared, and came up on the other side of the boat. Aswan was full of Turkish soldiers, who came and took away our donkeys, and stared at our faces most irreligiously. I did not go on shore at Kom Ombos or El Kab, only at Edfu, where we spent the day in the temple, and at Esna, where we tried to buy sugar, tobacco, etc., and found nothing at all, though Esna is chef-lieu with a mudr. It is only in winter that anything is to be got there for the travellers. We had to ask the Nazir in Edfu to order a man to sell us charcoal. People do without sugar, and smoke green tobacco, and eat beans, etc., etc. Soon we must do likewise, for our stores are nearly exhausted. We stopped at Al Montana and had a good dinner in the Munier's handsome house, and they gave me a loaf of sugar. Madame Munier described Rachel's stay with them for 3 months at Luxor, in my house, where they then lived. She hated it so, that on embarking to leave she turned back and spat on the ground, and cursed the place inhabited by savages, where she had been ennuyée à mort. Madame Munier fully sympathized with her, and thought no femme aimable could live with Arabs, who are not at all gallant. She is Levantine, and, I believe, half-Arab herself, but hates the life here, and hates the Muslims. As I write this, I laugh to think of the galanterie and Arab in one sentence, and glance at my brother Yusuf, who is sleeping on a mat, quite overcome with the simoom, which is blowing, and the fast which he is keeping today, as the eve of the Eid el-Kebir, great festival. This is the coolest place in the village. The glass is only 92.5 degrees now, 11 a.m., in the darkened divan. The Cadi and the Ma'un and Yusuf came together to visit me, and when the others left he lay down to sleep. Omar is sleeping in the passage, and Sally in her room. I alone don't sleep, but the simoom is terrible. Arthur runs about all day, sightseeing and drawing, and does not suffer at all from the heat. I can't walk now, as the sand blisters my feet. Tuesday, May 17th. Yesterday the simoom was awful, and last night I slept on the terrace and was very hot. Today the north wind sprang up at noon and revived us, though it is still 102 degrees in my divan. My old great-grandfather has come in for a pipe and coffee. He was Belzoni's guide, and his eldest child was born 7 days before the French under Bonaparte marched into Luxor. He is superbly handsome and erect, and very talkative, but only remembers old times, and takes me for Madame Belzoni. He is grandfather to Mohammed, the guard of this house, and great-grandfather to my little Achmet. His grandsons have married him to a tidy old woman to take care of him. He calls me my lady granddaughter, and Omar he calls Mustafa, and we salute him as grandfather. I wish I could paint him. He is so grand to look at. Old Mustafa had a son born yesterday, his 10th child. I must go and wish him joy, after which I will go to Arthur's boat and have a bathe. The sailors rig me out a capital awning. We had a good boat and a capital crew. One man, Mohammed, called Alati, the singer, sang beautifully, to my great delight, and all were excellent fellows, quiet and obliging. Only his servant was a lazy beast, dirty and conceited, a Copt spoiled by an Italian education and Greek associates, thinking himself very grand because he was a Christian. I wondered at the patience and good nature with which Omar did all his work and endured all his insolence. There was one stupendous row at Aswan, however. The men had rigged out a sort of tent for me to bathe in over the side of the boat, and Ramadan caught the Copt trying to peep in, and half strangled him. Omar called him dog, and asked him if he was an infidel, and Macarius told him I was a Christian woman, and not his harem. Omar lost his temper, and appealed to the old Rais and all the sailors. O Muslims, ought not I to cut his throat if he had defiled the noble person of the lady with his pig's eyes? God forgive me for mentioning her in such a manner. Then they all cursed him for a pig and an infidel, and threatened to put him ashore and leave him for his vile conduct towards noble Harim. Omar sobbed with passion, saying that I was to him like the back of his mother, and how dare Macarius take my name in his dirty mouth, etc. The cop tried to complain of being beaten afterwards, but I signified to him that he had better hold his tongue, for that I understood Arabic, upon which he sneaked off. End of letter 41. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 42 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Mrs. Austin, Luxor, Monday, May 23, 1864. Dearest Mutter, I meant to have written to you by Arthur Taylor, who left for Cairo yesterday morning, but the simoon made me so stupid that I could hardly finish a letter to Alec. So I begin one today to recount the wonders of the season here. I went over to Mustafa's island to spend the day in the tent, or rather the hut, of dura stalks and palm branches, which he has erected there for the threshing and winnowing. He had invited me and his worship the Maun to a picnic. Only imagine that it rained all day, a gentle slight rain, but enough to wet all the desert. I laughed and said I had brought the English weather, but the Maun shook his head and opined that we were suffering the anger of God. Rain in summertime was quite a terror. However, we consoled ourselves, and Mustafa called a nice little boy to recite the noble Koran for our amusement, and out of compliment to me he selected the chapter of the family of Amran, the history of Jesus, and recited it with marvelous readiness and accuracy. A very pleasant-mannered man of the Sharufa of Gurna came and joined us, and was delighted because I sent away a pipe which Abu Rahman brought me. It is highly improper to smoke while the Koran is being read or recited. He thanked me for the respect, and I told him I knew he would not smoke in a church, or while I prayed. Why should I? It rather annoys me to find that they always expect from us irreverence to their religion, which they would on no account be guilty of to ours. The little boy was a fellah, the child of my friend Omar, who has lost all his cattle, but who came as pleasant and smiling as ever to kiss my hand and wait upon me. After that the Maun read the second chapter, the cow, in a rather nasal, quavering chant. I perceived that no one present understood any of it, except just a few words here and there, not much more than I could follow myself from having read the translation. I think it is not any nearer spoken Arabic than Latin is to Italian. After this, Mustafa, the Maun, Omar, Sally, and I sat down around the dinner tray and had a very good dinner of lamb, fowls, and vegetables, such as Bahamias and Melukia, both of the Mallow order, and both excellent cooked with meat, rice, stewed apricots, mishmish, with nuts and raisins in it, and cucumbers and watermelons strewed the ground. One eats al durkheinander with bread and fingers, and a spoon for the rice, and green limes to squeeze over one's own bits for sauce. We were very merry, if not very witty, and the Maun declared, "Wahali, the English are fortunate in their customs, and in the enjoyment of the society of learned and excellent Harimat," and Omar, lying on the rushes, said, "This is the happiness of the Arab. Green trees, sweet water, and a kind face make the garden, paradise, an Arab saying." The Maun joked him as to how a child of Cairo could endure fellah life. I was looking at the heaps of wheat and thinking of Ruth, when I started to hear the soft Egyptian lips utter the very words which the Egyptian girl spake more than 1,000 years ago. "Behold my mother, where she stays I stay, and where she goes I will go. Her family is my family, and if it pleaseth God, nothing but the separator of friends, death, shall divide me from her." I really could not speak, so I kissed the top of Omar's turban, Arab fashion, and the Maun blessed him quite solemnly, and said, "God reward thee, my son. Thou hast honored thy lady greatly before thy people, and she has honored thee, and ye are an example of masters and servants, and of kindness and fidelity." And the brown laborers who were lounging about said, "Verily, it is true, and God be praised for people of excellent conduct." I never expected to feel like Naomi, and possibly many English people might only think Omar's unconscious repetition of Ruth's words rather absurd, but to me they sounded in perfect harmony with the life and ways of this country and these people, who are so full of tender and affectionate feelings, when they have not been crushed out of them. It is not humbug, I have seen their actions. Because they use grand compliments, Europeans think they are never sincere, but the compliments are not meant to deceive, they only profess to be forms. Why do the English talk of the beautiful sentiment of the Bible and pretend to feel it so much, and when they come and see the same life before them, they ridicule it? Tuesday. We have a family quarrel going on. Mohammed's wife, a girl of 18 or so, wanted to go home on Bairam Day for her mother to wash her head and unplait her hair. Mohammed told her not to leave him on that day, and to send for a woman to do it for her, whereupon she cut off her hair, and Mohammed, in a passion, told her to cover her face, that is equivalent to a divorce, and take her baby and go home to her father's house. Ever since he has been mooning about the yard, and in and out of the kitchen very glum and silent. This morning I went into the kitchen and found Omar cooking with a little baby in his arms, and giving it sugar. "Why, what is that?" say I. "Oh, don't say anything. I sent Ahmed to fetch Mohammed's baby, and when he comes here he will see it, and then in talking I can say so-and-so, and how the man must be good to the harem, and what is this poor, small girl going to do when she is big enough to ask for her father? In short, Omar wants to exercise his diplomacy in making up the quarrel." After writing this I heard Mohammed's low, quiet voice, and Omar's boyish laugh, and then silence, and went to see the baby and its father. My kitchen was a pretty scene. Mohammed, in his ample brown robes and white turban, lay asleep on the floor with the baby's tiny pale face and little eyelids stained with kohl against his coffee-brown cheek, both fast asleep, baby in her father's arms. Omar leant against the fournaise in his house-dress, a white shirt open at the throat and white drawers reaching to the knees, with the red tarbouche and red and yellow kufia, silk handkerchief round it turban-wise, contemplating them with his great soft eyes. The two men made an excellent contrast between Upper and Lower Egypt. Mohammed is the true Arab type, coffee-brown, thin, spare, sharp-featured, elegant hands and feet, bright, glittering small eyes and angular jaw, not a handsome Arab, but bien caractérisé. Omar, the color of new boxwood or old ivory, pale, with eyes like a cow, full lips, full chin and short nose, not the least negro, but perfectly Egyptian, the eyes wide apart, unlike the Arab, mustache like a woman's eyebrow, curly brown hair, bad hands and feet, not well made, but graceful in movement and still more in countenance, very inferior in beauty to the pure Arab blood which prevails here, but most sweet in expression. He is a true Akul and Banat, brother of girls, and truly chivalrous to harem. How astonished Europeans would be to hear Omar's real opinion of their conduct to women. He mentioned some Englishman who had divorced his wife and made her frailty public. You should have seen him spit on the floor in abhorrence. Here it is quite blackguard not to forfeit the money and take all the blame in a divorce. Friday. We have had better weather again, easterly wind and pretty cool, and am losing the cough and languor which the damp of the simoom brought me. Sheikh Yusuf has just come back from Kenna, whither he and the Cadi went on their donkeys for some law business. He took our saddle-bags at Omar's request, and brought us back a few pounds of sugar and some rice and tobacco. Isn't it like Fielding's novels? It is 2 days' journey, so they slept in the mosque at Kus halfway. I told Yusuf how Suleiman's child has the smallpox, and how Mohammed only said it was min Allah, from God, when I suggested that his baby should be vaccinated at once. Yusuf called him in and said, "O man, when thou wouldst build a house, dost thou throw the bricks in a heap on the ground and say the building thereof is from God? Or dost thou use the brains and hands which God has given thee, and then pray to him to bless thy work? In all things do the best of thy understanding and means, and then say min Allah, for the end is with him." There is not a pin to choose in fatalism here between Muslim and Christian. The lazy, like Mohammed and Suleiman, one Arab and the other Copt, say min Allah, or any form of dwaddle you please, But the true Muslim doctrine is just what Yusuf laid down. Do all you can and be resigned to whatever be the result. Fais ce que dois advienne qui pourra is good doctrine. In fact, I am very much puzzled to discover the slightest difference between Christian and Muslim morality or belief, if you exclude certain dogmas, and in fact very little is felt here. No one attempts to apply different standards of morals or of piety to a Muslim and a Copt. East and West is the difference, not Muslim and Christian. As to that difference, I could tell volumes. Are they worse? Are they better? Both and neither. I am, perhaps, not quite impartial, because I am sympathique to the Arabs and they to me, and I am inclined to be kind to their virtues, if not blind to their faults, which are visible to the most inexperienced traveller. You see, all our own familiar bunkum, excuse the vulgarity, falls so flat on their ears. Bravado about honour, veracity, etc., etc., they look blank and bored at. The schoolboy morality, as set forth by Maurice, is current here among grown men. Of course we tell lies to pashas and beys, why shouldn't we? But shall I call in that ragged sailor and give him an order to bring me up £500 in cash from Cairo when he happens to come? It would not be an unusual proceeding. I sleep every night in a macabre sort of veranda, open to all Luxor, and haven't a door that has a lock. They bother me for bakshish, but oh, how poor they are, and how rich must be a woman whose very servants drink sugar to their coffee, and lives in the Khazar palace, and is respectfully visited by Ali Bey. And, come to that, Ali Bey would like a present even better than the poorest fella, who also loves to give one. When I know, as I now do thoroughly, all Omar's complete integrity, without any sort of mention of it, his self-denial in going ragged and shabby to save his money for his wife and child, a very great trial to a good-looking young Arab, and the equally unostentatious love he has shown to me, and the delicacy and real nobleness of feeling which come out so oddly in the midst of sayings which, to our ideas, seem very shabby and time-serving, very often I wonder if there be anything as good in the civilized West. And, as Sally most justly says, all their goodness is quite their own. God knows there is no one to teach anything but harm. Tuesday. Two poor fellows have just come home from the Suez Canal work with gastric fever, I think. I hope it won't spread. The wife of one said to me yesterday, "Are there more sitat ladies like you in your village?" "Wallah," I said, "there are many better and good doctors, alhamdulillah." "Alhamdulillah," said she, "then the poor people don't want you so much, and by God you must stay here, for we can't do without you, so write to your family to say so, and don't go away and leave us." Thursday, June 2nd. A steamer has just arrived which will take this letter, so I can only say good-bye, my dearest mother, and God bless you. I continue fairly well. The epidemic here is all but over, but my medical fame has spread so that the poor souls come 20 miles from Kus for physic. The constant phrase of, "O our sister, God hath sent thee to look to us," is so sad. Such a little help is a wonder to my poor fellaheen. It is not so hot as it was, I think, except at night, and I now sleep half the night outside the house. The cattle are all dead, perhaps 5 are left in all Luxor. "Allah Karim, God is merciful," said Fella Omar. "I have 1 left from 54. The grain is unthreshed, and butter 3 shillings a pound. We get nothing here but by post. No papers, no nothing. I suppose the high Nile will bring up boats. Now the river is down at its lowest, and now I really know how Egyptians live." End of letter 42, read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 43 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Sir Alexander Duff Gordon, Luxor, Sunday, June 12, 1864. Dearest Alec, 3 letters I have received from you within a few days, for the post of the Said is not that of the Medes and Persians. I have had an abominable toothache, which quite floored me, and was aggravated by the Oriental custom, namely, that all the beau monde of Thebes would come and sit with me, and suggest remedies, and look into my mouth, and make quite a business of my tooth. Sheikh Yusuf laid two fingers on my cheek, and recited verses from the Koran, I regret to say with no effect, except that while his fingers touched me, the pain ceased. I find he is celebrated for soothing headaches and other nervous pains, and I dare say is an unconscious mesmerizer. The other day our poor Ma'oun was terrified by a communication from Ali Bey, Mudir of Kenna, to the effect that he had heard from Alexandria that someone had reported that the dead cattle had lain about the streets of Luxor, and that the place was pestilential. The British mind at once suggested a counter-statement, to be signed by the most respectable inhabitants. So the Cadi drew it up, and came to read it to me, and took my deposition and witnessed my signature, and the Ma'oun went his way rejoicing, in that the words of the Englishwoman would utterly defeat Ali Bey. The truth was that the worthy Ma'oun worked really hard, and superintended the horrible dead cattle business in person, which is some risk and very unpleasant. To dispose of 300 or 400 dead oxen every day with a limited number of laborers is no trifle, and if a traveling Englishman smells one a mile off he calls us lazy Arabs. The beasts could not be buried deep enough, but all were carried a mile off from the village. I wish some of the dilettanti who stop their noses at us in our trouble had to see or to do what I have seen and done. June 17th. We have had 4 or 5 days of such fearful heat with a simoom that I have been quite knocked up, and literally could not write. Besides, I sit in the dark all day, and am now writing so, and at night go out and sit in the veranda, and can't have candles because of the insects. I sleep outside till about 6 a.m., then go indoors till dark again. This fortnight is the hottest time. Today the drop falls into the Nile at its source, and it will now rise fast and cool the country. It has risen 1 cubit, and the water is green. Next month it will be blood color. My cough has been a little troublesome again, I suppose from the simoom. The tooth does not ache now, alhamdulillah, for I rather dreaded the muezzin, barber, with his tongs, who is the sole dentist here. I was amused the other day by the entrance of my friend the Ma'oun, attended by Osman Effendi and his kawas and pipe-bearer, and bearing a saucer in his hand, wearing the look, half sheepish, half cocky, with which elderly gentlemen in all countries announce what he did, i.e. that his black slave girl was 3 months with child and longed for olives, so the respectable magistrate had trotted all over the bazaar and to the Greek corn dealers to buy some, but for no money were they to be had, so he hoped I might have some and forgive the request, as I, of course, knew what a man must beg or even steal for a woman under those circumstances. I called Omar and said, I trust there are olives for the honorable harem of Salim Effendi. They are needed there. Omar instantly understood the case, and, praise be to God, a few are left. I was about to stuff the pigeons for dinner with them. How lucky I had not done it. And then we belabored Salim with compliments. Please God, the child will be fortunate to thee, says I. Omar says, Sweeten my mouth, O Effendium, for did I not tell thee God would give thee good out of this affair when thou boughtest her? While we were thus rejoicing over the possible little mulatto, I thought how shocked a white Christian gentleman of our colonies would be at our conduct to make all this fuss about a black girl. He gave her 6 pence, under the same circumstances, I mean. He'd see her damned first, and my heart warmed to the kind old Muslim sinner, as he took his saucer of olives and walked with them openly in his hand along the street. Now the black girl is free, and can only leave Salim's house by her own good will, and probably after a time she will marry and he will pay the expenses. A man can't sell his slave after he has made known that she is with child by him, and it would be considered unmanly to detain her if she should wish to go. The child will be added to the other 8 who fill the Ma'oun's quiver in Cairo, and will be exactly as well looked on, and have equal rights if he is as black as coal. A most quaint little half-black boy, 1.5 years old, has taken a fancy to me, and comes and sits for hours gazing at me, and then dances to amuse me. He is Mohammed, our guard's son, by a jet-black slave of his, and is brown-black and very pretty. He wears a bit of iron wire in 1 ear, and iron rings around his ankles, and that is all, and when he comes up, little Achmet, who is his uncle, makes him fit to be seen by emptying a pitcher of water over his head to rinse off the dust, in which, of course, he has been rolling. That is equivalent to a clean pinafore. You would want to buy little Said, I know. He is so pretty and so jolly. He dances and sings and jabbers baby Arabic, and then sits like a quaint little idol, cross-legged, quite still for hours. I am now writing in the kitchen, which is the coolest place where there is any light at all. Omar is diligently spelling words of six letters, with the wooden spoon in his hand and a cigarette in his mouth, and Sally is lying on her back on the floor. I won't describe our costume. It is now 2 months since I have worn stockings, and I think you would wonder at the fellaha who owns you. So deep and brown are my face, hands, and feet. One of the sailors in Arthur's boat said, "See how the son of the Arabs loves her. He has kissed her so hotly that she can't go home among English people." June 18th. I went last night to look at Karnak by moonlight. The giant columns were overpowering. I never saw anything so solemn. On our way back we met the Sheikh el-Beled, who ordered me an escort of 10 men home. Fancy me on my humble donkey, guarded most superfluously by 10 tall fellows with, oh, such spears and venerable matchlocks. At Mustafa's house we found a party seated before the door and joined it. There was a tremendous Sheikh el-Islam from Tunis, a Maghribi, seated on a carpet in state receiving homage. I don't think he liked the heretical woman at all. Even the Ma'on did not dare to be as politeful as usual to me, but took the seat above me, which I had respectfully left vacant next to the holy man. Mustafa was in a stew, afraid not to do the respectful to me, and fussing after the sheikh. Then Yusuf came fresh from the river, where he had bathed and prayed, and then you saw the real gentleman. He salaamed the great sheikh, who motioned to him to sit before him, but Yusuf quietly came round and sat below me on the mat, and leaned his elbow on my cushion, and made more demonstration of regard for me than ever, and when I went, came and helped me on my donkey. The holy sheikh went away to pray, and Mustafa hinted to Yusuf to go with him, but he only smiled and did not stir. He had prayed an hour before down at the Nile. It was as if a pure curate had devoted himself to a rank papist under the eye of a scowling Shaftesbury bishop. Then came Osman Effendi, a young Turk, with a poor devil accused in a distant village of stealing a letter with money in it addressed to a Greek moneylender. The discussion was quite general, the man, of course, denying it all. But the Nazir had sent word to beat him. Then Omar burst out, "What a shame to beat a poor man on the mere word of a Greek moneylender who eats the people. The Nazir shouldn't help him." There was a Greek present who scowled at Omar, and the Turk gaped at him in horror. Yusuf said, with his quiet smile, "My brother, thou art talking English," with a glance at me, and we all laughed, and I said, "Many thanks for the compliment. All the village is in good spirits, the Nile is rising fast, and a star of most fortunate character has made its appearance, so Yusuf tells me, and portends a good year and an end to our afflictions. I am much better today, and I think I too feel the rising Nile. It puts new life into all things. The last fortnight or 3 weeks have been very trying with the simoom and intense heat. I suppose I look better for the people here are forever praising God about my amended looks. I am too hot, and it is too dark to write more." End of letter 43. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 44 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Sir Alexander Duff Gordon, Luxor, June 26, 1864. Dearest Alec, I have just paid a singular visit to a political detenu, or exile, rather. Last night Mustafa came in with a man in great grief, who said his boy was very ill on board a Kangia, just come from Cairo and going to Aswan. The watchman on the river bank had told him that there was an English cit who would not turn her face from anyone in trouble, and advised him to come to me for medicine, so he went to Mustafa and begged him to bring him to me, and to beg the Kawas, policeman, in charge of el-Bedrawi, who was being sent to Fazoglo in banishment, to wait a few hours. The Kawas, may he not suffer for his humanity, consented. He described his boy's symptoms, and I gave him a dose of castor oil, and said I would go to the boat in the morning. The poor fellow was a Cairo merchant, but living at Khartoum. He poured out his sorrow in true Eastern style. Oh, my boy, and I have none but he, and how shall I come before his mother, a Habashia, O lady, and tell her, thy son is dead? So I said, Allah Karim Yasedi, and Inshallah Tayyib, etc., etc., and went this morning early to the boat. It was a regular old Arab kanjia, lumbered up with corn, sacks of matting, a live sheep, etc., and there I found a sweet, graceful boy of 15 or so in a high fever. His father said he had visited a certain pasha on the way, and evidently meant that he had been poisoned or had the evil eye. I assured him it was only the epidemic, and asked why he had not sent for the doctor at Kenna. The old story, he was afraid. God knows what a government doctor might do to the boy. Then Omar came in and stood before El Bedrawi and said, O my master, why do we see thee thus? Mash'Allah, I once ate of thy bread when I was of the soldiers of Said Pasha, and I saw thy riches and thy greatness, and what has God decreed against thee? So El Bedrawi, who is or was one of the wealthiest men of Lower Egypt and live at Tanta, related how Effendina, Ismail Pasha, sent for him to go to Cairo to the citadel to transact some business, and how he rode his horse up to the citadel and went in, and there the Pasha at once ordered a Kawas to take him down to the Nile and on board a common cargo boat, and to go with him and take him to Fazoglo. Letters were given to the Kawas to deliver to every mutter on the way, and another dispatched by hand to the governor of Fazoglo with orders concerning El Bedrawi. He begged leave to see his son once more before starting, or any of his family. No, he must go at once and see no one. But luckily a fella, one of his relations, had come after him to Cairo, and had 700 pounds in his girdle. He followed El Bedrawi to the citadel, and saw him being walked off by the Kawas, and followed him to the river and on board the boat, and gave him the 700 pounds which he had in his girdle. The various mutters had been civil to him, and friends in various places had given him clothes and food. He had not got a chain round his neck or fetters, and was allowed to go ashore with the Kawas, for he had just been to the tomb of Abul Hajjaj, and had told that dead sheikh all his affliction, and promised, if he came back, to come every year to his Mulid festival, and pay the whole expenses, i.e. feed all comers. Mustafa wanted him to dine with him and me, but the Kawas could not allow it, so Mustafa sent him a fine sheep and some bread, fruit, etc. I made him a present of some quinine, rhubarb pills, and sulfate of zinc for eye lotion. Here you will know we all go upon a more than English presumption, and I believe every prisoner to be innocent and a victim. As he gets no trial, he can never be proved guilty. Besides, poor old El Bedrawi declared he had not the faintest idea what he was accused of, or how he had offended Effendina. I listened to all this in extreme amazement, and he said, Ah, I know you English manage things very differently. I have heard all about your excellent justice. He was a stout, dignified-looking, fair man, like a Turk, but talking broad Lower Egypt fella talk, so that I could not understand him, and had to get Mustafa and Omar to repeat his words. His father was an Arab, and his mother a Circassian slave, which gave the fair skin and a reddish beard. He must be over 50, fat and not healthy. Of course he is meant to die up in Fazoglo, especially going at this season. He owns, or owned, for God knows who owns it now, 12,000 feddans of fine land between Tanta and Samuhod, and was enormously rich. He consulted me a great deal about his health, and I gave him certainly very good advice. I cannot write in a letter, which I know you will show what drugs the Turkish doctor had furnished him with, to strengthen him in the trying climate of Fazoglo. I wonder, was it intended to kill him, or only given in ignorance of the laws of health equal to his own? After a while the pretty boy became better and recovered consciousness, and his poor father, who had been helping me with trembling hands and swimming eyes, cried for joy, and said, By God the Most High, if I ever find any of the English, poor or sick or afflicted up in Fazoglo, I will make them know what I, Abu Muhammad, never saw a face like the pale face of the English lady bent over my sick boy. And then El Bedrawi and his fellow kinsmen and all the crew blessed me and the captain, and the Kawas said it was time to sail. So I gave directions and medicine to Abu Muhammad and kissed the pretty boy and went out. El Bedrawi followed me up the bank and said he had a request to make. Would I pray for him in his distress? I said, I am not of the Muslimin. But both he and Mustafa said, Malish, never mind, for that it was quite certain I was not of the Mushkirin, as they hate the Muslimin and their deeds are evil, but blessed by God, many of the English begin to repent of their evil and to love the Muslims and abound in kind actions. So we parted in much kindness. It was a strange feeling to me to stand on the bank and see the queer, savage-looking boat glide away up the stream, bound to such far more savage lands, and to be exchanging kind farewells quite in a homely manner with such utter aliens in blood and faith. God keep thee, lady. God keep thee, Mustafa. Mustafa and I walked home very sad about poor El Bedrawi. Friday, July 7th. It has been so awfully hot that I have not had pluck to go on with my letter, or indeed to do anything but lie on a mat in the passage with a minimum of clothes quite indescribable in English. Alhamdulillah, laughs Omar, that I see the clever English people do just like the lazy Arabs. The worst is not the positive heat, which has been above 104 degrees and as low as 96 degrees at night, but the horrible streams of hot wind and dust which are apt to come on at night and prevents one even lying down till 12 or 1 o'clock. Thebes is bad in the height of summer on account of its expanse of desert and sand and dust. The Nile is pouring down now gloriously and really red as blood, more crimson than a Herefordshire lane, and in the distance the reflection of the pure blue sky makes it deep violet. It had risen 5 cubits a week ago. We shall soon have it all over the land here. It is a beautiful and inspiring sight to see the noble old stream as young and vigorous as ever. No wonder the Egyptians worshipped the Nile. There is nothing like it. We have had all the plagues of Egypt this year. Only the lice are commuted for bugs, and frogs for mice. The former have eaten me, and the latter have eaten my clothes. We are so ragged. Omar has one shirt left, and has to sleep without it and wash it every night. The dust, the drenching perspiration, and the hard-fisted washing of Mohammed's slave woman destroys everything. Mustafa intends to give you a grand fantasia if you come, and to have the best dancing girls down from Esna for you, but I am consternated to hear that you can't come till December. I hoped you would have arrived in Cairo early in November, and spent a month there with me, and come up the river in the middle of December when Cairo gets very cold. I remain very well in general health, but my cough has been troublesome again. I do not feel at all like breathing cold, damp air again. This depresses me very much, as you may suppose. You will have to divorce me, and I must marry some respectable Cadi. I have been too lazy Arab, as Omar calls it, to go on with my Arabic lessons, and Yusuf has been very busy with law business connected with the land and the crops. Every harvest brings a fresh settling of the land. Wheat is settling at £1 the ardeb here on the threshing floor, and barley at 116 piastres. I saw some Nubians pay Mustafa that. He is in comic perplexity about saying Alhamdulillah about such enormous gains. You see, it is rather awkward for a Muslim to thank God for dear bread, so he compounds it by very lavishly almsgiving. He gave all his fellaheen clothes the other day, 40 calico shirts and drawers. Do you remember my describing an Arab emancipris fraulein at Siut? Well, the other day I saw, as I thought, a nice-looking lad of 16 selling corn to my opposite neighbor, a Copt. It was a girl. Her father had no son and is infirm, so she works in the field for him, and dresses and does like a man. She looked very modest and was quieter in her manner than the veiled women often are. I am glad to hear such good accounts of my Rainey and Maurice. I can hardly bear to think of another year without seeing them. However, it is fortunate for me that my lines have fallen in pleasant places. So long a time at the Cape or any colony would have become intolerable. Best love to Janet. I really can't write. It's too hot and dusty. Omar desires his salam to his great master and to that gazelle, Sitti Ross. End of letter 44. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. Letter 45 of Letters from Egypt by Lady Lucy Duff Gordon. Read for LibriVox.org into the public domain. To Sir Alexander Duff Gordon, Luxor, August 13, 1864. Dearest Alec, for the last month we have had a purgatory of hot wind and dust, such as I never saw, impossible to stir out of the house. So in despair I have just engaged a return boat, a Gelegenheit, and am off to Cairo in a day or two, where I shall stop till, inshallah, you come to me. Can't you get leave to come at the beginning of November? Do try. That is the pleasant time in Cairo. I am a stupid, lazy Arab now, as Omar says, having lain on a mat in a dark stone passage for 6 weeks or so, but my chest is no worse. Better, I think, and my health has not suffered at all, only I am stupid and lazy. I had a pleasant visit lately from a great doctor from Mecca, a man so learned that he can read the Quran in 7 different ways. He is also a physician of European hekmah, learning. Fancy my wonder when a great alim in gorgeous Hegazi dress walked in and said, Madame, tout ce qu'on m'a dit, de vous fait tellement l'éloge de votre cœur et de votre esprit, que je me suis arrêté pour tâcher de me procurer le plaisir de votre connaissance. A lot of Luxor people came in to pay their respects to the great man, and he said to me that he hoped I had not been molested on account of religion, and if I had I must forgive it, as the people here were so very ignorant, and barbarians were bigots everywhere. I said, Wahali, the people of Luxor are my brothers. And the Ma'un said, True, the fellaheen are like oxen, but not such swine as to insult the religion of a lady who has served God among them like this one. She risked her life every day. And if she had died, said the great theologian, her place was made ready among the martyrs of God, because she showed more love to her brothers than to herself. Now, if this was a humbug, it was said in Arabic before 8 or 10 people, by a man of great religious authority. Omar was aux anges to hear his Sitt spoken of in such a grand way for the religion. I believe that a great change is taking place among the ulema, that Islam is ceasing to be a mere party flag, just as occurred with Christianity, and that all the moral part is being more and more dwelt on. My great alim also said I had practiced the precepts of the Quran, and then laughed and added, I suppose I ought to say the gospel, but what matters is, el-haq, the truth, is one, whether spoken by our Lord Jesus or by our Lord Muhammad. He asked me to go with him to Mecca next winter for my health, as it was so hot and dry there. I found he had fallen in with el-Bedrawi and the Khartoum merchant at Aswan. The little boy was well again, and I had been outrageously extolled by them. We are now sending off all the corn. I sat the other evening on Mustafa's doorstep and saw Greeks piously and zealously attending to the divine command to spoil the Egyptians. 8 months ago a Greek bought up corn at 60 piastres the ardeb. He follows the Coptic tax-gatherer like a vulture after a crow. Now wheat is 170 piastres the ardeb here, and the fellah has paid 3.5% a month besides. Reckon the profit! 2 men I know are quite ruined, and have sold all they had. The cattle disease forced them to borrow at these ruinous rates, and now, alas, the Nile is sadly lingering in its rise, and people are very anxious. Poor Egypt, or rather, poor Egyptians. Of course, I need not say that there is a great improvidence in those who can be fleeced as they are fleeced. Mustafa's household is a pattern of muddling hospitality, and Mustafa is generous and mean by turns. But what chance have people like these, so utterly uncivilized and so isolated, against Europeans of unscrupulous characters? I can't write more in the wind and dust. You shall hear again from Cairo. End of letter 45. Read by Sibella Denton. All LibriVox files are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.